Well, we have a very special guest this morning, and it's a former Navy man. What he did with a white fleet is something that I greatly appreciate. But may I introduce, it gives me great pleasure to introduce the 26th President of the United States, President Theodore Roosevelt. Sir.
Delighted to be here. And isn't it a bully day? I'm glad to see all your faces facing towards me. I'm not sure you're going to pay attention to me or that magnificent view out your plane windows. Either way, I will glory in your attention. Yes, I was the 26th President of the United States. I was that unfortunate President of the United States, for I came to the presidency through the auspices of an assassin's bullet. In 1901, I was in Colorado in this time of year for the quadricentennial of the state of Colorado, and I spoke in many places around here. And Mr. McKinley was visiting other places in the East, and in September 6th, as a matter of fact, Mr. McKinley visited Buffalo to the Pan American Exposition, where he was on a handshaking line, and a gentleman came out of the line with a bandage on his hand, stretched out his hand as if to shake Mr. McKinley, who went over with open palm to him, and instead he discharged a 36 caliber bullet, mortally wounding my president. I was rushed to his side and dismissed after 2 days because Mr. McKinley seemed to rally and was going to recover, and I was dismissed, as the vice presidents always were, because the vice presidency was considered to be an instant ticket to oblivion. A matter of 6 days later, I was summoned back to his bedside in Buffalo. I was on the top of Mount Marcy in the Adirondacks. I'd been hiking for 40 miles, and they rushed up to gather me, wasting 2 horses in doing so. And I came back down to base camp with the knowledge that Mr. McKinley had expired, and I could not move. For the heady responsibility of becoming the president was waving over me like a crushing wave in the ocean. The responsibility of guiding this country is an enormous responsibility and should not be taken lightly nor quickly. My handlers wanted to get me down off the hill into the railroad station, North Creek Station, and I said no. I paused and I stopped and I prayed and I said the responsibility that I'm about to take is one of great importance and I need help in doing it. I went on to Buffalo and I was sworn in as the 26th President of the United States. And as such, I made changes in this country. But as I prepare before you today, I am approaching my 60th birthday. And I am not as greatly of health as I have been in the past. My left leg, I injured it in 1913 on the Amazon River, jumping in to save a boat. And the incision that occurred has never truly healed and the infection has come back to haunt me. My asthma has returned and my doctors have informed me that I have a confounded inflammation of my joints, a rheumatoid arthritis that is inflammatory and is keeping me at Sagamore Hill. But I came to speak to you today on a message of great importance. We are involved in a worldwide conflict. All of my family is fighting in the Great War. Even my daughter Ethel and her husband are tending to the wounded outside of Paris. My oldest son Theodore is with Black Jack Pershing. Kermit took a commission with the British Expeditionary Force in Mesopotamia. Archie is an infantry captain in France. And my youngest son Quentin is an army aviator. And as such, I worry about them every day. I worry about them because I am not there to lead them. I worry about them because they are in danger, but they are serving this country, which is the primary duty of a citizen. I was reading the papers the other day, and I volunteered to bring a group of people together as I had done in the Spanish War. I could have enlisted 200,000 people with just my name. The President of France and the Prime Minister of England wrote to Mr. Wilson asking for permission to do so, to lend my name to the volunteer army, but he declined out of a reason I shall not put before you. But in the newspapers that were recording this, They said that I was born to lead. And that began to me questioning what leadership actually is. Was I born to lead? I think not. There was only one man born to lead, and he was crucified 2,000 years ago. Leaders are not born. Leaders are created by their environment, by their families, by their education, and by the country that loves them, and they love that country. A man, a plain man, can step up and become a leader of his own right. We are not created. We are not born. We are created by our environments and by our lessons that we have learned. And in the creation of a leader, you have to have courage. Of course you have to have courage. The physical courage to stand up for yourself is not uncommon. It is the moral courage to stand up for what is right that is uncommon. And that's what a leader does. He stands up for the moral right of the people around him, himself, and his country. Physical courage is fine. I myself was afraid of many things in my life. I was asthmatic as a child. I was afraid of the great outdoors, and still I began to build my body. And still, when I became a huntsman, and by the way, the lady that had a bear, let me meet you afterwards because I've had some frequency with bears. But when I was a huntsman, danger was around me, but I made up my mind that I would not be afraid, that I would act unafraid, even though I was terrified. If you act unafraid, you will become unafraid. If you act with the moral courage that you have to act in a responsible fashion, you can stand up to anything as long as you are confident in yourself. And by acting unafraid, you convince yourself you're not afraid. A leader, whether he is afraid or not, will not show fear. Another thing a leader does is action, action, action. Once you have made up your mind, once you have been approached by a problem, assess the problem. Look at what you can do with what you have where you are. That is a phrase from my father. It'll be repeated many times. But take action in it. If you're right, you have solved it. If you're wrong, you have advanced the process to solution. But the worst debauchery in history can be to give good words to a problem and do nothing at all. You must take action when you see it, where you are, with what you have, and do what you can to solve that situation. When you're a leader, you're expected to have followers. But you should never put yourself ahead of the people you are leading. A leader will lead by example. I did so in 98 when we formed the Rough Riders. I hated that name at first. It was the first volunteer cavalry, after all. The first United States volunteer cavalry. A noble ring to it. The newspaper said it was the Rough Riders. Indeed, Rough Riders. But my colonel came to me and said, "You're wrong, Theodore. The men will respond to that because they want to run roughshod over the Spanish in the Caribbean. And you are their leader. And as such, you need to train with them." A leader will not ask anyone in his following to do something he is unwilling to do. So when we trained with the Rough Riders, I was crawling through the mud with them. I was riding horses with them, firing from horseback, doing everything that they did in their training with them. And I was unafraid to be with them. And I can assure you, out of the 968 troopers we had in the Rough Riders, they were all my friends. And they all were leaders, and they were all following me. Because you never put yourself above the people that you are leading. And leaders are learners. You have to learn throughout your entire life. Once you have reached maturity, you say, I don't need to study math. I don't need to study anything. I do not need to learn anything more. I know it all. And if you do that, you're not a leader. You're a follower. You're a sham. Leaders are learners. Lifetime learning is what you need to do because it will enrich you. It will make your mind stronger and if need be, it will change your mind for the better. Travel enriches you. Books will create you. Books will enhance you. And knowledge is never, ever wasted. And a leader will never stop learning. You need to bring history to life and create your new future. If you say, deny history as being old, tired, and worn out, and has no bearing on what you're doing today, you're absolutely wrong. There is nothing under the sun that has not happened before. You just need to learn about it. And you cannot denigrate the people that went beyond you before you. You must learn from them. And from that knowledge, create a new future for yourself. Leaders are learners. Leaders put history into context. Leaders use history as their foundation for creation of their new processes. A leader also maintains open channels with his adversaries. You must never, ever have the concept of winner takes all. You must have an open communication with those people that oppose you, because you must come to a consensus if you're going to lead. You must have that ability to talk to them as well as they talk to you. If you shut off communications, you will never, ever lead. But you have to take your opponent into consideration. You have to make them part of the solution. You have to bring them to the table for negotiations. You have to make sure that those lines of communication are open and relevant. A leader keeps his commitments, perhaps one of the two foundations of leadership. And I refer back to the Cowboy Code. The first tenet of the Cowboy Code is you keep your promises. Bottom line, that is the primary basis for the Cowboy Code. Everything else in the world, even in the Ten Commandments, you keep your word. You keep your commitments to the best of your ability until you are either proven wrong or proven right. The foundation of trust is keeping your word. And trust is the foundation basis of leadership. If you have that, if you don't have that commitment, you don't have a leader. And one of the other primary tenets, as I see here, it is family first. Your family counts more than any other thing in your life. A firm foundation of a family basis, whether it's your parents, grandparents, second great grandfathers, your children, they come first in your life to care and nurture and take care of them. If you can do that, then you're a leader. In the White House, I always made time for my children. I called it Children's Hour. At 4 o'clock every day, I stopped working of whatever I was doing in the Oval Office or in the West Wing. I created the West Wing, by the way. And I would stop and I would go to my children and we would play for an hour and a half. Whatever they wanted to do, I did. If they wanted me to ride on me like a horse, I got down on all fours. If they wanted to pitch horseshoes or go out to the shooting range or ride horses, whatever my children wanted to do, I was theirs for an hour or more. Because I never fully grew up myself. I wanted to be a child all of my life. And the childlike enthusiasm of your children will bolster you and make you whole and give you the hope of things to come. A loving wife and a loving husband are the basis for the foundation of the courage that you need to lead. The foundation of a family that has a heritage, no matter what it is fundamental to leadership and one of the three most important tenets of leadership. And finally, the most important part of leadership, beyond courage, beyond knowledge, beyond putting people ahead of yourself, is be authentic. Live your values. If you have values from the church, from God, from whatever. If you have values that you treasure, lead and live them. I have tried to do that all of my life, and people that don't live their values, that change from one instance to another, depending upon who they're talking to, are not leaders, they are followers. But be authentic in yourself. Know who you are. Know what you can do. Be authentic and live your values, and you surely will be a leader. Have I always lived up to these in my lifetime? I've tried. I have not always done so. But it is the trying that happens. It is not to the critic that counts. Not to the man who tells another man, a brave man, how he could have done more, or a doer of deeds, how he could have done better. It is not to the critic that counts, but it is to the man who is actually in the arena, the man whose face is stained with blood and sweat and tears, the man who tries valiantly and fails and gets up and tries again. It is that man that belongs to credit, because he will know the great exaltations of spending himself in a deed worth doing. And he will know only the fate, the faint sufferings of defeat. The critic, the naysayer, the man who tells him that he could not do it, will know none of this, because he will have never attempted greatness. Be that man in the arena and you will prosper. Take advantage of everything that you have. Learn from every day of life. Learn from history and learn from your family the humbling nature that you need to have to lead, and you will be outstanding in whatever you do. It took me a while to learn this. As I was a child, I was asthmatic. And when I was about 10, my father pulled me aside. I had been reading all of my life. When I was 2, I would drag Dr. Stanley's book around behind me, and if someone was sitting in a chair, I'd plop myself in their lap and have them read to me about the plates, the drawings in that book. I was reading Shakespeare by 7. I read the Iliad and the Odyssey by the time I was 9, and I understood Shakespeare by the time I was 9. But my father looked at me, and we got the report back from the doctors. They said, Theodore will have to live a sedentary life all of his life. His heart is too frail and his asthma is too great. He will not be able to do anything strenuous, so keep him in the house and don't let him do anything that might hurt him. Now, my father knew me better than that, and he pulled me aside and he set me down. All of a sudden, he started construction on the second floor of our house on East 20th Street in New York City. None of us knew what was happening. But he set me down and he said, Theodore, you have a mind that will take you far in life, but your body will not cross the threshold to get you there. The secret to your life is that you and you alone are responsible for it. You and you alone are responsible for making your life happy or sad. You are responsible for everything that happens to it. People can help you or hinder you, but it's your decision to make a life. And it's your decision whether you want to live a sedentary life or would you like to do something about it. I said, Father, I want to do something about it. I've not been allowed to play outside with my brothers and sisters. I have not been allowed to go to school. What can we do? And he said, I have taken care of that. He took me to the second floor solarium that had been under construction all spring. And there was a gymnasium laid out for me. He said, it's your responsibility to build your body. I was barely 115 pounds at 11 years old. I had Indian clubs. I had medicine balls. I had a drawing machine on the floor, solid mahogany and brass springs as big around as my forearm. And I went to work using the Indian clubs to stretch my shoulders and my chest. The medicine ball, my brother and I passed around 3 different weights. I went to the rowing machine. I could not do the first stroke. It took me 2 months to do a stroke. I was bored with it. My brother said, don't you want to quit? And I said, I do, but I want to do something better. I have learned that if I express myself, I can do better. And I took to it 3 hours every day. And by the time I was 14, I was ready to go to summer camp. I had gained a grand total of 20 pounds. I was 130 pounds. I had legs like a bird, but I was 130 pounds. And they allowed me to go to summer camp in Maine. On the train, there were 4 bullies in that train, all picking on me because I was slight in size, I had glasses because my father had taken me to an oculist and gave me pince-nez glasses, and they picked on me all the way up to the train. The counselor picked us up at the depot, and he saw what was happening, and he said, "Do you want to learn how to defend yourself?" And I said, "Yes." So we took up boxing lessons in camp. And I thought, what a magnificent thing to do. I boxed all during the camp, went back home suffering the same slings and arrows from those four bullies. And I went home and I told my parents, "I want to learn how to box." My mother said, "No, that is not a gentlemanly thing to do. You will not learn how to box. That is pugilism, and I will not have it in my house." My father thought for a moment. He objected. And he said, "It might be just the thing." My father was the most brilliant man I ever knew, and the only man I'm truly afraid of, and not afraid of him because of physical retribution, but I was afraid to disappoint him. And he finally consented to it, and he brought in a champion boxer from the ring, a bare-knuckled boxer. They had to toe the mark for 15 rounds, and they did not get paid, and he taught me how to box. Taught me the skills to bob and weave and move around the ring. When I went back to summer camp the next year, the same four bullies were on the train. I did not have to do anything because I stood up because I knew I could take them. I did not have to do it. I learned. I had self-confidence. I had the moral courage to stand up to them. I was created as a leader because I could box. I knew I could box. I followed each of the tenants on that trip, and I became friends with them. I boxed the rest of my life. The learning curve and the learning of things that are beyond you enriches you and makes you qualified to lead. And as I leave you today, the thing that has followed me all of my life, the motto that has guided me from a weak asthmatic child to magna cum laude in Harvard to leading 900 men up Kettle Hill outside of Santiago, Cuba, to the presidency and beyond. I have followed the tenets as best I could of leadership, but always keeping in mind that humanity must come first. But the guiding motto that has led me through this, I will leave you in close. Do what you can with what you have, where you are, and you will succeed beyond your wildest dreams. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. President. One of our colorful leaders of our history's past. And actually, let me pick up a couple of things that just wisdom for us, especially as a family in the church. Talking about the one truly great leader who was created, our chief shepherd. Put your team ahead of yourself, the chief shepherd who died for his sheep. Leaders are learners. We talk a lot about our responsibility to be transformed by the renewing of our minds. Not be conformed to this world. Bring history to life and then create a future. That's why I read 1 Corinthians. The historical fact, the history of what Christ did on the cross, the reality and history of the resurrection, leading to the end of 1 Corinthians 15, the future we have, the ultimate hope we have, because it is grounded in history to create a heavenly future. And I like that. Maintain open channels with adversaries. Sin, folks. And that Jesus directly addressed that. The greatest adversary of all. Keep commitments. Something good for us. Something the president valued in his life. Aren't you glad that God keeps his commitments even when we fail? Family first. Aren't you glad we are a family because of what Jesus Christ has done? And the foundation, I greatly appreciated that, the foundation of a nuclear family, the bedrock upon which society, governments, very important, obviously biblical. And then be authentic. Live your values. Folks, we're Christians. We are ambassadors for Christ, and we need to represent Him in everything we do. So thank you for the words of wisdom, Mr. President.